the Sky News Centre at 5. Three people have been found guilty of murdering a woman whose body was found in a burnt-out car in Somerset last year. Catherine Wells Burr from Chard was smothered by her boyfriend Rafael Novak before his secret lover and her uncle dumped her body and set fire to it. Bristol Crown Court heard they were trying to secure her life insurance. Catherine's mother Jane describes the attack as cruel, callous and sickening.
The hatred shown to her truly shocked us, and especially the hatred shown by Rafael Novak, who was meant to have loved her. The betrayal to our family has devastated us, and we treated him like a son and a family member.
A teenage paedophile who raped an 11-year-old girl in a park in North London has been jailed for at least 8 years. Opamipo Jaji was on probation when he attacked a girl on her way home from school in Enfield last year. He's carried out previous attacks but wasn't on the sex offenders register. It's been business as usual for the Queen today, who's been heard saying she has no idea how her husband is. The Duke of Edinburgh was due to have a planned exploratory operation after he was admitted to hospital yesterday. In a speech at the BBC's headquarters, he did get a mention.
I remember first coming to Broadcasting House with my father, the King, and my mother and sister shortly before the war. I came again with the Duke of Edinburgh just before the coronation in 1953.
Vodafone has revealed that for a second year running, it's paid no corporation tax in the UK. The mobile phone giant says it's because it spent so much on investment in its network and paying interest charges. And researchers say a new non-invasive blood test can reliably detect if an unborn baby has Down syndrome. It analyses a baby's DNA present in its mother's blood. The test's been found to be more sensitive and return fewer false positive results than current methods. That's the latest. I'm Matt Steele.
You can listen to BCFM live on the internet and also download every show as a podcast at bcfm.org.uk.
What do you like, you dumb thing?
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Helping us review this week's news, we hope, he's on his way here, not quite yet, is Labour councillor for Bedminster and Mayor Ferguson's cabinet member for residents' parking zones. Well, it must feel like that. Actually, it's transport. Mark Bradshaw, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Bilderberger and former Justice Secretary with the Tories, Ken Clark's plans to decimate legal aid and end access to justice in Britain are running aground as barristers across the country come out on the streets to protest. We take a good look at NATO's secret Bilderberg meeting taking place in the UK for the first time in 15 years right now in Watford. Martin Summers and I will swap roles as he grills me about this secretive NATO group that were chaired for their first 20 years by a former SS officer. We go back to the last days of the Second World War II to find another Bilderberg chairman, Lord Carrington, sitting in his Sherman tank drinking tea when he should have been charging down the road with only 3 hours to go to save British paratroopers at Arnhem. Plus, if we have time, the Chief Constable of Cambridgeshire, Tom Lloyd, believes the police have lost the war on drugs decades ago and that the only way to fight the cartels is to end prohibition, just like the Americans did back in the 1930s, with the state officially controlling and taxing drugs. Plus, Martin Summers takes us on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. That's in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 13 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 20 Celsius and sunny. Next week, temperatures highs up to 20, a fairly sunny and dry week. Next weekend, that's the 15th and 16th of June, highs of 20 Celsius, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news will be, in a minute, Labour Councillor for Bedminster and Mayor Ferguson's Cabinet Member for Transport, Mark Bradshaw. But while we're waiting, we'll have a chat to old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, Labour seems to have taken an incredible change in tact this week. Capping benefits, they're not capping rents, but they're capping benefits, and means testing pensioners. They're not means testing the royal family. So what's going on? Why this big change on their welfare policy?
Well, I mean, you've got to think about two things that they need to take on board. One is what the government is doing. One is what they need to do to win an election. So they're looking at focus groups, what focus groups are saying. And so they're now trying to nail down their economic policy, you know, in terms of, you know, what they would do if they were in government. I think really when Ed Balls is saying that he's going to cut the welfare bill, what I have to say is if there is a crash and the economy goes down the drain, the welfare bill will go up willy-nilly. He can talk about cutting it, but that's all very well, isn't it?
I mean, it seems
in the real world, may well be that they can't cut it at all.
I mean, it seems, you know, however much the bankers are responsible for the situation we're in, the Labour Party's basically caved in and given in to their agenda, which is, oh, I'm sorry, we don't have any money anymore.
Yes, it is. They were always going to do that. It's no point people being disappointed. They're a mainstream political party trying to manage the mainstream economy, and therefore they've got to come out with what the mainstream expects.
Well, they're listening to Mervyn King, aren't they? They're basically saying... hear me out, right? They're listening to Mervyn King when he says, oh, we've got to stop bashing the bankers. Now, as we heard last week and many previous weeks, there's been no real banker bashing. The bankers haven't really been punished for their crimes.
No, they haven't. And I think also the Labour Party have bought into this idea. What does it say here? That there are some people who don't want to work and we've got to deal with that. That is really, really off the wall, frankly. When you've got nearly 3 million unemployed, and we've always had 1 million unemployed at least in the last 30 years, talking about people not wanting to work is irrelevant. We should be moving towards a citizen's income where we guarantee people an income, whether they work or not.
I mean, there's
that's the sort of thing we should be talking
estimates
about.
Are, I think it was the Roundtree Foundation last week came out with this roughly 1 million jobs gap. Other reports have said 3 million. There are 3 million jobs needed, full-time jobs. There are jobs out there, but they're part-time jobs.
Well, that's right. And of course, you can say we are going to cut the welfare bill. The government is saying we are going to cut the welfare bill. Now, if there is a major bloody downturn in the economy, then they will not be able to cut the welfare bill. It's just not, you know, if
can I just interrupt you and apologise for your swearing?
Yes,
because I don't think we should be swearing at all.
No.
Apologies to listeners for that.
Sorry about that.
Cutting the welfare bill is necessary now, isn't it? Because we're in a difficult situation, just like other. I mean, we're doing better than many of the other parts of Europe, but we're certainly not. We're not doing as well as Greece, or we're doing better than Greece and Italy, etc.
But we need to
cut our welfare bill now, surely.
No, we don't. The Icelandic welfare bill has gone up, because that's what you do when people are in trouble and there's a difficulties. You give them more money, not less, and that actually protects the economy. Now, in other words, they've bought into the wrong... I mean, Ed Balls has bought into this whole nonsense. And, of course, when he comes to power, if he comes to power, the welfare bill will be what it is, and he won't be able to control it in the way that he thinks any more than the government can now.
So do you think it makes sense to means test pensioners? Surely it does.
Well,
I mean, you know, if they're very rich, they don't need government help.
Fair enough, and that is actually not that much of a problem. More of a problem is the idea that he can predict in advance what the welfare bill is going to be. It depends on the state of the economy, doesn't it? The welfare bill will depend on whether we've got any growth or not, and if we haven't got any growth, the welfare bill will go up.
It sounds to me as if we're moving away from a time when we'll be able to rely on benefits to help people who are in difficult situations. And that's something which is happening across the board, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we're being softened up for that, aren't we? We're going to have to live like the Americans, where you get unemployment benefits, but only for, you know, a few months, and then you're on your own. That's happens quite a lot all over the world, where there isn't actually permanent benefits for people.
But I mean, inevitable as a result of the financial situation we're in, surely?
No, it's not. In actual fact, what you need to do if you want to get out of the mess is you've got to give people protection. You've got to give them solidarity. You've got to make sure that they're okay.
But that's not the government's job.
Yes, it is. Yes, it certainly is. It certainly is the government's job to make sure that the ordinary people are looked after. And if the bankers have to pay for that, well, they have to pay for it. And the Labour Party here, the problem we've got a first-past-the-post electoral system. So Ed balls is saying this in order to try and win over the voters in Basildon, but as he's saying this, he's losing all the voters in Scotland. He's losing all the voters in Wales. The people in Northern Ireland just aren't interested in this. It's the middle class, middle England that gets fed up about welfare, and they're the people who decide elections. The few hundred thousand voters in the swing constituencies around London, and they've got to be kept happy. It's all got to revolve around the pea brains of these people. Elsewhere in the country, of course, as Labour moves to the right, the SNP will take over there, in Scotland will simply take over their role. They will say, well, we don't talk like that. People on benefits are not scroungers, they are our people and we're going to look after them.
Yeah, one of the headlines in Monday's Guardian, Bilderberg guest list includes George Osborne and Ed Balls. So they're in this secret meeting in Watford.
Heads with Henry Kissinger.
Heads of the big tax avoiding firms also set to attend secretive groups, four-day summit being held in Watford. Chancellor George Osborne is a guest of the secret Bilderberg group. And his Labour shadow Ed Balls on the list of those attending this week's UK summit of the secretive group, alongside the heads of Amazon and Google, both of whom are under unprecedented political pressure over their company's aggressive tax avoidance policies. Jeff Bezos, Amazon's founder and chief executive, and Google's executive chairman Eric Schmidt will rub shoulders with dozens of other figures from the global political and financial elite at the annual four-day meeting. Now, I start to wonder, especially when I see Ed Balls coming out and Ed Miliband, coming out with this kind of policy to do with, punishing, the idea of capping benefits and not capping rent seems to me a no-brainer. The Labour Party should be doing that. This isn't really a traditional Labour policy at all. They seem to have actually adopted the Nick Clegg approach, which is being a human shield for Conservative policy and actually Bilderberg policy.
That's right, and I think what they're doing is they're accepting the government's terms of reference, which they will do. Don't forget, they're trying to win a general election where they've got to win over those swing voters in those middle England seats, so they've got to accept the government's way of talking.
But they don't, as an opposition, they don't. They're supposed to not accept the government's point of view. They're supposed to oppose it.
I'm not at all surprised that they're saying this sort of stuff. They're bound to say it in order to try and get elected. But as I say, if the economy takes a downturn, if the euro collapses and the banks collapse, the welfare bill is going up, not down, up.
Okay, so I mean, I suppose they're doing is they're trying to cut their cloth before all that happens, aren't they?
Yes, but of course they're all whistling in the wind, because if things take a turn for the worse, it's all nonsense anyway.
Okay, GPs, on to another story here. GPs who hit the 111 jackpot. This is a great little story in the Mail this week. It's the helpline that's meant to save patients like baby Axel. But as this devastating dossier reveals, the biggest beneficiaries are the fat cat doctors who made millions from a firm that runs it. Well, they say doctors at the headline there. But actually, it turns out quite a lot of them are very close to the Conservative Party and also former Labour Health Secretary. Harmony, Britain's largest urgent care provider, has been sold for £25 million to the GP's co-op that was formed in Harrow, North London in 1996. All the five doctors who founded it are now millionaires. The firm's expanding massively, despite claims it stretched to breaking point. Last year it was sent out Mayday texts to doctors begging them to work for it. And so, I mean, Martin, this is a privatisation too far, it seems. This 111 service is getting criticism all over the country too. And it's probably one of the reasons, after having a terrible time phoning it, people end up in the accident and emergency.
Well, that's right. It's shocking, really, isn't it? I don't mind doctors being well paid, but why are doctors millionaires? They're not businessmen, they're doctors. They should get on with being doctors, shouldn't they?
A new service for non-emergency medical problems and out of hours, that's the 111 service, partly run by Harmony, Harmoni, which is founded by these doctors we heard about. That is in turn owned by Care UK, founded by Tory donor John Nash, who gave £21,000 to the personal office of Health Secretary Andrew Lansley. The firm's new Managing Director of Healthcare, Jim Easton, is a former member of NHS Commissioning Board, which awards 111 contracts to health firms, such as Harmony. Martin, this is becoming... It's almost like a banana republic. It's the friends of friends awarding massive amounts of government money, on which we rely to live, from the health service, to their mates.
Yes, and all of these mates, when they put people to work, that's all counted as extra private sector jobs created, even though in actual fact it's government money, every penny of it. I mean, but we call it private sector.
Isn't the purpose of this actually to feather the nests of cronies and also to make the public angry, to get us out on the streets protesting.
No, I don't think they want to make us angry. What they want to do is they want to...
They want this
Conservative government coalition is going to be a one-term government. So by the time they're cuffed out, they want to make sure that the NHS is good and truly busted so that we can't rebuild it. That's what the game is.
Now, Care UK, in turn, is owned by Bridgepoint, a private equity firm, which employs former Health Secretary... Guess who? Your Alan Milburn, Martin.
Oh,
as chairman of the advisory committee, it was Milburn who renegotiated GPs' contracts, opening the way for private health companies such as Harmony to provide out-of-hours care. Well, more cronyism, more revolving doors. I mean, really, it seems to me that the health service at the moment, is because of these people and because of these changes, is staggering around with knives in it.
Yes, and Alan Milburn used to be a Trotskyist, can you believe, back in the day. I mean, the New Labour Conservative coalition consensus about all of these things is shocking, really shocking.
So what are we going to do about it? What is the Labour Party going to do about it? Anything?
Well, what you've got to recognise is that the Labour leadership is the Labour leadership and they do what they do, and then there's the Labour movement, the wider movement. And ultimately, I believe the ball will fall to us because they don't know how to manage the economy, any of them. They're going to actually make a mess of it, and when they do... then we're going to start talking seriously about what we need to do to really reform this economy. And we're not talking about cutting benefits.
Surely people don't... It's not that they don't know how to manage it. They don't care about managing it. All they care about is taking money for their friends.
No, what they want to do is they just want to manage the existing situation and hope that it's the problems that they've got will all go away. They won't all go away. Ultimately, we're going to have to completely revamp the way we run our economy. Completely revamp it. Massive state investment in all sorts of things, from healthcare to infrastructure to education. We're going to provide people with a basic income which they won't have to work for. Ultimately, all of this will come onto the agenda, but first of all, we've got to run the car into the wall and put everybody's head through the windscreen, and then we'll be able to put it all back together again. We shouldn't have to do this, but that's really the way of it.
I mean, surely we had promises, didn't we, before the 2010 election from David Cameron, specifically about the health service, no top-down reorganisations. It seems that we've got several top-down reorganisations going on at the same time here. Also, on BBC Question Time yesterday, one of the members of the audience was saying the last thing that you need in a recession with a difficult situation on health funding is to have changes in the way things are organised.
Yeah, I mean, that's gratuitous, isn't it? We've got enough problems to deal with the economy stuttering and the potential for a crash, so why don't we disorganise everything while we're going, completely try and change the welfare system, universal credit, completely change the NHS, completely change the way we run the police force, completely change everything. That would be difficult to do, even if the economy was humming along. And in a situation where the economy is going down the drain, it's absolutely insane to be carrying through all these changes all at once. And, of course, there will be chaos, bound to be.
What about changes to the system which allows... this revolving doors cronyism, you know, with Bridgepoint, Care UK and Harmony, Martin, and awarding this massive 111 helpline. I mean, personally, if I was ill, or a member of my family was ill, or a loved one, I would hesitate to phone this number at all. I don't have any confidence from what I've heard about people that have phoned it that it's going to deliver the goods at all.
Well, you remember when they brought in these very different telephone lines to phone when you wanted to find a number? I mean, there used to be, back in the day, do you remember when BT used to be the monopoly supplier? There was a number that you called to find out any information you wanted to find. It was just one number. Now, of course, there's a multiplicity of numbers to call, and, of course, nobody knows which number to call because there's too many of them. Sometimes choice just makes things more complicated.
Now, another story. Asda are to donate a surplus food stock to charity. That's Asda, which is sending its food stock to a food bank charity instead of returning it to manufacturers, creating up to 3.6 million meals annually for the homeless and vulnerable people. The supermarket said the first of its kind deal would increase the amount of food distributed by Food Share by 41% and save local charities at least £4 million. All Asda suppliers have signed up to the scheme, which will prevent up to 1,500 tonnes of food being sent to landfill because it's out of date, Martin.
Well, I mean, in a way, you'd say, well, isn't this good? They're not going to throw this stuff away. And of course, that's good. We shouldn't be throwing food away. But you see, what Asda really need to be doing is paying people a living wage so we don't have to subsidise their workforce, and then they'd have enough money to buy the food, wouldn't they, instead of having it given to them.
What about the idea of out-of-date food? Surely, actually, once food is out-of-date, it's not fit for human consumption.
Well, that's right, isn't it? At what point do we say we're not going to feed this to you? We're going to feed it to the pigs.
I mean, isn't it part of a story we were looking at a few weeks ago about dehumanising the poor in this country? That actually, if it's not fit for human consumption, but it's fit for the consumption of the poor, we're starting to get into some rather Victorian territory.
That's right, and we're not going to give you welfare benefits. We're going to give you old sandwiches that are out of date, and you will be grateful. And that's the future.
And is there any comeback if someone gets food poisoning from one of these, I wonder?
That's a question, isn't it?
Food poverty is a very real problem. It's getting worse, not better, commented, as does Chief Merchandising Officer Barry Williams. Through our new supply chain model and work with Fair Share, I'm proud we're able to help feed millions of families around the UK who would otherwise go to bed hungry. Now, this is incredible that we've actually come to this, isn't it?
Well, yes, and it's going to get worse.
Ultimately, though, Asda has started to do this. You think it's really the duty of the other supermarkets to do it? I mean, certainly around this city, you'll find that some of the people who are on the poverty line actually penniless, completely penniless. The only way they can survive is to go skipping, you know, diving into skips out the back of supermarkets and finding food. So, I mean, I would imagine that that happens at Asda. So instead of that, there will be other people further down the food chain who will go hungry because of this new system with Asda and the food charities.
When are Asda going to pay their people a wage that we don't have to subsidise it by the taxpayer? Because that would be the most useful thing they could do, wouldn't it? Pay your people so that we don't have to subsidise their rent, you pay them what you need, and if you can't pay them, maybe you shouldn't be in business. Maybe you shouldn't be running a business if you can't pay people a living wage.
Well, I'll tell you who does get paid from Asda's profits. That's their shareholders. I mean, that's one of the reasons that they're a very successful company is because people invest in Asda.
Yes, and of course what they've done there, basically Walmart, and what they've done in the US is they bring in all of the stuff from China, they sell it at rock bottom prices, and they don't pay a living wage over there either. And all of the work, in other words, they are part of the process by which American jobs have all gone to China, and then of course they then provide food to food banks to feed people when people used to have high paying, well paid manufacturing jobs. They've now got a food bank, courtesy of Asda.
Do you think Asda is any different to the other supermarkets? They're surely all going to just follow suit.
They're the bottom feeders, yeah? They're the ones who actually make it difficult for the others.
You say call them the bottom feeders, how come they're doing more than the other supermarkets to help, you know, provide food for people who haven't got any?
Well, I mean, they're doing PR, aren't they? The others will all catch up with this. I mean, basically, this is all, as I say, none of them are paying a living wage to their workers, and they're all working these schemes that the government are doing, where people are working for them for nothing and so on. I mean, and then they give us some food, and we're supposed to be grateful.
Okay, another story. Flying in the face of austerity, Britain. This is a positive story for a change. Britain took delivery of more private jets than any other European country during the years of economic gloom. Beechcraft delivered 232 aircraft to UK customers from 2007 to 2011. The figure's up 47% on the so-called boom years of 2002 to 2006. So at least some people are doing very well, Martin. The UK has Europe's second largest registered fleet of business aircraft. Of course, the same is true for light aircraft, for private planes. It's doing very well.
Yes, maybe some of our millionaire doctors have bought some, eh? I mean, what we've actually got is a situation where the people at the top are making out like bandits. The idea that we're all in this together is ridiculous. And that's one of the reasons, of course, why the people at the top don't really take the crisis seriously. Because there isn't a crisis for them. With all the quantitative easing and all the rest of it, the assets of the wealthy classes have been boosted. They're all making... The stock market is racing ahead. They're all making paper profits. And they're spending it on aircraft. Meanwhile, of course, we're talking about giving people... out-of-date food in food banks at the other end of the spectrum.
Still no sign of Mark Bradshaw, who was supposed to be here about an hour ago. So maybe he's got stuck in the traffic because of cars parked in the wrong place and trying to sort out the residence parking. Anyway, a great pity, because we all want to hear what's going on with residence parking, Mark. So let's hope you can get here quickly. Now on to Prime Minister's questions this week. And we had a long, long break of no Prime Minister's questions. Back in the old days, Martin, used to be two a week, didn't they, of 15 minutes each, I think. And now and then they've conglomerated it to one Prime Minister's questions. And now we've had a situation for weeks and weeks where there's been, for one reason or another, Margaret Thatcher's funeral, various other reasons, things like that, that there's no Prime Minister's questions at all. And I think you could tell why this week. The Prime Minister, David Cameron, did seem very, very rattled as Ed Miliband tackled him over the problems with accident and emergency.
Mr. Speaker, there are people all around this country waiting for hours and hours in A&E, and all they see is a complacent, out-of-touch Prime Minister reading out a list of statistics, not about A&E. People want to know about the crisis in A&E happening on his watch. Now let's talk about the causes of this. In the government's first 2 years in office, more than a quarter of NHS walk-in centres were closed. Now, if you close NHS walk-in centres, you pile pressure on A&E departments. That's obvious to everyone else. Why isn't it obvious to him?
To talk about the causes of the problems in A&E, and I accept in the first quarter of this year there were problems and we need to get to grips with them. One of the problems is the GP's contract that was signed by the last Labour government. They signed a contract that basically let GPs get out of hours. And if he wants evidence from that, perhaps he will listen to the Labour minister in the NHS at the time. Fortunately, he lost his seat in North Warwickshire to a Conservative. But this is what he says. In many ways, GPs got the best deal they ever had from that 2004 contract, and since then, we have, in a sense, been recovering. That is what happened. 1 million more people coming through our doors, an excellent performance by doctors and nurses, but let down by the last Labour government.
Martin, it would be nice to have Mark's comments on this too, but this actually seems to me to be one of the fundamental reasons why we have this crisis in accident and emergency, is because so many walk-in centres have been closed. I mean, this is the path of least resistance, accident and emergency, isn't it? Mm.
Yes, and I think the points the Prime Minister made about the GP's contract are fair points. But on the other hand, GPs did deserve a better deal. I don't like millionaire doctors, but I want them properly paid and I don't want them overworked. I mean, basically, what you get is what you pay for. I mean, we want a first-class NHS, don't we? So let's make sure we get one.
Now, what about solutions? I mean, how to sort this out? Just reopen walk-in centres?
Well, if it's a question of resources, make sure you've got enough resources, because you shouldn't be scrimping on things like healthcare. It's the most important thing that we ever spend any money on. Who needs a second widescreen TV? You need proper healthcare, and yet it's not the sort of thing that we want to be scrimping on at all. It's a false economy in every way. And of course, what's really happening is the disorganisation of the health service, because of ideology from the government, is creating chaos. And of course, ultimately, it'll be very difficult to make this aquarium back into, they're making an aquarium into fish soup, and it'll be very difficult to make fish soup back into an aquarium. And of course, that's the whole strategy. Once they've broken the NHS up, they've created all this new landscape, then it's going to be really, really difficult to rebuild it, and that's the whole idea.
Well, we did hear last week, didn't we, from Protect Our NHS, which is quite a well-organised little group in Bristol, meeting, I think, once a week in one of the pubs, and also doing some serious lobbying. Some serious lobbying, that is to say, going into some of these new meetings that are taking place as the new restructured health service, and asking the right questions, making sure that, I mean, because the thing is, in some of these new organisations, as we were hearing last week, there's some vested interest sitting in the room to such an extent that they have a financial interest in certain outcomes from the NHS now.
Yes.
Personal financial interest with their own private businesses.
Absolutely. And of course, the government have promised in their manifesto no top-down reorganisation of the NHS. And you can see it from space. It's ridiculous.
Okay, so now we're going to go to the Home Affairs Select Committee, and Keith Vaz was talking to the head of counter-terrorism at the Metropolitan Police, Cressida Dick.
Is this a Metropolitan Police investigation with you at its head as the head of counter-terrorism? Or is it an investigation that is being jointly conducted with the security services? Or has their role, in a sense, come to an end? This is a full-fledged Met Police investigation into terrorism as opposed to a murder.
This is a police investigation into what happened on that day. Police-led and strongly, very strongly supported by the security services and indeed other agencies, as you would expect.
But it's your investigation?
It is our investigation.
And you will go to other agencies who might be able to assist you?
Absolutely. I mean, clearly, we need and have needed from the first moment to ensure not only we identify those responsible for the murder and we bring them to justice, but we also want to identify anyone else who might seek to commit a copycat or indeed a revenge attack. And we have to also ensure that we've identified whether there was anybody else involved in the planning or indeed at the scene of the attack. And I can say we have established at the moment we have no evidence that there was anybody else present at the scene of the attack.
Well, it doesn't sound like she's giving a lot away there, but she's talking, Martin, about the balance between the police looking into this Woolwich attack and MI5. Now, it seems the police have been fairly even-handed with both sides of this, that is to say, the Islamist threat and also the far-right threat. But what about MI5?
Well, that's a question, isn't it? I mean, frankly, given what we know about the Western Intelligence Services, that the Al-Qaeda franchise was set up by them during the Operation Cyclone in the 1980s. MI6 was the lead agency on that. If people look at the film Charlie Wilson's War, which starred Tom Hanks as Senator Charlie Wilson, they were boasting about the fact that they set up the Al-Qaeda was set up by the Western Intelligence Services, and that's why the police have to do the investigation. It looks like they tried to recruit one of these killers in Woolwich, and the brother of one of them was definitely recruited by the intelligence services. Now you've got to start asking questions about who is pulling the strings here. And if it sounds paranoid and all the rest of it, it's not. It's perfectly straightforward. That's why the police service of Northern Ireland, what they call the NIPS over there, was set up. Not the RUC, not the intelligence services, the NIPS. And that's because the intelligence services are often suspects, I'm afraid. They just are.
Have MI5 been involved with Islamist groups here in Britain? I mean, yep. There's certainly suggestions that Alma Jaroon was thoroughly, if not largely, infiltrated by MI5. And the Finsbury Park Mosque with Abu Hamza and his crowd, Haroon Aswat, at Finsbury Park Mosque, the local mosque, reported them to the police. But then it looks like the police were kind of told by MI5, leave it alone, it's one of our little operations
Aswat was arrested in various places around the world, and both because the Americans wanted him for running a training camp in Oregon. So the Americans have got a warrant out for his arrest. He gets arrested in South Africa, he gets arrested in Afghanistan, I think he was arrested in Pakistan, and every time he's arrested, he's let go because the British say to the local authorities, never mind, let him go, he's working for us. People in Northern Ireland know about all these things, about infiltration, about the intelligence services, the idea that they're the good guys. Then some of them are the good guys. I'm not saying that they're all bad guys, but on the other hand, the idea that they are completely to be trusted is completely wrong.
Well, isn't it a fact that as part of Operation Gladio, the intelligence services actually killed police in order
Fernando Imposimato is the honorary head of the Italian Supreme Court. He's just produced a book called The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres. And with all the information he's got from the Italian police force, he's the head of the Supreme Court, basically the intelligence services were involved in terrorism in this country. They kidnapped the Prime Minister, they blew up Bologna Railway Station, they started with a bomb in Piazza Fontana in 1969. This is not conspiracy theory, this is historical fact. Western intelligence services are terrorists. They are. And it's not something that's a conspiracy theory, it's a fact that's been found out by the Italian police force. And that, of course, means the British intelligence services are definitely in that loop. That's why the police must investigate these matters, and they must investigate the intelligence services as well. If that's where the lead leads, that's where it leads.
Well, it's not just the Italians also, Martin, is it? It's also the Swiss and Belgian parliamentary inquiries. Anyway, I'm very pleased to say Mark Bradshaw has managed to make it. Nice to see you, Mark. You are the Labour councillor for Bedminster and Mayor Ferguson's cabinet member for transport. Now, first of all, are you vying with the Lib Dems to become the Mayor's human shields? Because you've got a hell of a job on here, haven't you, with residence parking?
Well, Tony, it's good to be here. And I think that, you know, if my mind casts back to last November, there was pressure on Labour to join Mayor Ferguson's cabinet. We decided not to at that stage. After the May elections, we looked at it again. Obviously, now we're the biggest party on the council. We took a view to join. So, you know, we get things chucked at us if we do, and things we don't, and things chucked at us if we don't. You know, we are there as part of a a cross-party administration for the good of the city, giving the mayor robust advice, you know, and occasionally that is in agreement with what the mayor wants, and occasionally it's not. But that's the whole point of having an advisory cabinet.
But does it feel like a dictatorship by George?
No, but these are tough issues, and you know, I supported the concept of an elected mayor for Bristol because I think that Bristol needed leadership and direction. We had a revolving door of council leaderships over certainly the period that I've been a councillor since 2006. People have worked very hard for the good of the city. I'm not decrying the contribution that the different leaders and cabinets have made, but actually having a mayor balanced by effective cross-party scrutiny, balanced by a very clear role for cabinet, is extremely important. Extremely important that you've got those checks and balances in place.
Okay, before we get into residence parking, your favourite subject, what about the? We've dealt with a couple of subjects on here already, one of which is A&E and the crisis in A&E. Many people saying, in fact your leader, pointing it out at question time this week in London, that that actually it's largely to do with the closed down of the walk-in centres. What are your thoughts about why we've got this crisis, and really, is this a form of privatisation that's going on?
Well, if you cast your mind back to the last election, you know, the Conservatives promised no top-down reorganisation of the NHS, and what have they been doing over the last couple of years? They've been reorganising the NHS. They've been inflicting huge damage to the organisational capacity within the NHS, and the walk-in centres were one of the really big positive innovations about access to healthcare, about supporting GP surgeries, about supporting the community hospitals, and obviously we've got a very good modern hospital now in South Bristol, but actually taking walk-in centres away has reduced and made it more difficult for people to access quality healthcare. So it's no wonder that the queues are piling up in A&E, and I never thought that we'd go back to a position where people are now waiting on trolleys in corridors at A&E. You know, that was unacceptable when it happened. Labour, you know, got rid of that, and we were criticised for targets and so on, but they worked. And now we seem to have drifted back to the 80s and early 90s.
What about the other? Another story we looked at was this sort of change of tack in the Labour Party this week by Ed Balls and Ed Miliband, the Eds. Labour is now in favour of capping benefits. It's not capping rents, private landlords' rents or anything like that. It's capping benefits. And also means testing pensioners. But I'm afraid the super rich, the aristocracy, the Queen and Prince Charles, says no means testing of them. The Queen's just got a £5 million pay rise.
Well, far be it from me to comment on the settlement for the royal family, but I do think that on the one hand, Labour is asked to spell out in great detail its plans, you know, should Labour become the government in 2015, and on the other hand, when it tries to promote a debate about the future of welfare, about the balances that are required and the very difficult economic inheritance that a Labour government will almost certainly have in 2015, you know, you can't really have it both ways. And I think that what's happened this week is just an explanation that, you know, a new Labour government during 2015 onwards, should one be elected, will have that tough inheritance, and you know, things will be very different, you know. But I think equally, you know, and I know there's a debate on things like the bedroom tax. You know, my view is very clearly that that is a repressive tax. And it is a tax. I know some in the media disagree on that, and I've had various arguments.
Yes, well, John Darvill on BBC Radio Bristol was saying, oh, it's not a tax. That's because right. You can only be taxed on income. Oh. I was thinking, hang on, there's about 1,000 other taxes, precisely. John. So is this the party you joined, Mark?
The party I joined is about fairness, but also about growth. And I think you've got to balance the growth agenda with making sure that the limited resources that will be available for the foreseeable future are targeted on those in greatest need. And we still know that in the country There are a very large number of people who are living in poverty, who have particular needs and requirements. I'm just not sure at the moment where David Cameron is on child poverty, you know, eliminating child poverty, because getting rid of Sure Start, or at least undermining Sure Start, must be one of the most regressive steps that his government has actually taken. Of course, it's not just the Tories, it's the Lib Dems in there as well.
But you didn't answer my point, though, about the rent, because it would surely make much more sense from a Labour Party point of view, at least the Labour Party I understand exists, to be capping rents, not to be capping benefits, to be saying to landlords, no, you're not allowed to take the biggest market rent that you can, which is often astronomical, and often also very bad conditions people are living in for that.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's obviously a debate about housing benefit, and I think for every £100 spent on housing benefit, 95% goes on rent payment, and only 5% is invested in improving the condition of the rented property and in building new property. And part of my brief from the mayor is about how we get more affordable housing built in the city. So clearly I'm very keen to see much more investment being targeted at improving the standards, particularly in the private rented sector, because we've done a lot in council housing and social housing to improve the standards. It's in the private rented sector, and of course more people have moved into the private rented sector because they can't afford to buy or may have lost their homes.
So why is there no control? Issue. Why are we not hearing from Ed some control over these private rents, which are going through the roof at the moment? Well, if I'm not allowed to say that with rents, but they are. I mean, they're going up and up, and there's a massive new demand for private rented accommodations, which is being caused by the bedroom tax.
Well, one thing that I'm very keen on is if we can get more supply into the market, if we can get more affordable homes being built and returning empty homes into the marketplace, you've not got the sort of scarcity value that currently exists, certainly within this city, where there is a decreasing supply of rented property and rents, you're quite right, are going up. I'm not sure rent controls would work. I'm open to the debate, but I do want to see more money being invested in building new homes and improving the quality and standards of homes.
Well, they used to work, didn't they? I mean, you used to have some sort of rent setting organisation. Yes. I mean, it used to work. Why not now?
Yes. Well, I'm interested in that, and I think in Bristol, you know, I want to see greater publicity around rights for tenants, so the tenants know that their rights. I want to see us to, you know, be able to encourage good landlords and good agents, and to, you know, find some way to take action against those that are not good.
Okay, well, now time to get stuck into some, let's talk about residents' parking zones. What stage is this at? Because it seems to be that there's been a lot of criticism of the speed at which Mayor Ferguson's trying to implement these, and the possibility of going to local government ombudsman, all this kind of thing. So what's the latest, Mark?
Well, what the mayor's done is he's flagged up a very serious issue in the city, which is not new. It's how we control the demand for on-street parking. It's not unusual. Most other cities, I think all the other cities of a comparable size in the UK, have been down this journey and have in place regimes to control on-street parking. It is about air quality, and I was in a debate with somebody the other day on the radio who was basically saying that there's not an air quality problem here in Bristol. Well, there is. And there's a growing number of children now with respiratory illnesses. We know the move to diesel has had a retrogradus impact. And we know that pollutants in the atmosphere are growing. So we've got to take action. And, of course, there's congestion, rising cost of the congestion. Everybody moans about it. It also prevents our public transport network from working efficiently. So it was right for the mayor to raise this. Part of the job that I've got is to look at the detail around how you implement this.
Well, one of your colleagues, Steve Pearce,
looks like.
One of Steve Pearce was on here last week saying, well, look, why don't you just do the parts of the city where there is agreement that there's a resident parking zone needed, and then delay a little while to get public agreement on the other places. Also, you know, we were originally told that the residents' parking schemes was to stop commuters, you know, but actually many of these areas don't have parking problems at all.
Well, I think it's important that we consult, engage with local ward councillors, with neighbourhood partnerships, and we spend time on doing that.
But are you still going to try and do it all at once, or bit by bit?
Well, there is a debate to be had. What the mayor has done is he's flagged up this as an issue for the city. He wants people to engage. He wants the business community to engage. And I was meeting some of the business representatives last night.
Would they have steam coming out of their ears?
No, because they realise there's a problem in the city as well. But also, they want us to deal with the detailed issues that they've raised and come up with a scheme that actually works, which actually benefits the city. And as I say, part of the task that I've got is working with our officers to design a scheme which is highly sensitive to local conditions, but is also enforceable and is also understandable. There's no point having a different parking regime on every street, but actually we've got to be sensitive to neighbourhoods, travel within those neighbourhoods, and some of the issues that the business community has raised, okay, particularly about moving between zones.
Are you still wedded to this idea of introducing it all together at one big go next year, with every area of the city the same at the same time?
I say, there's a discussion which is continuing.
That sounds
around.
Like, that sounds like a no. You're not absolutely wedded to it. You may consider another.
No, because that's why we're consulting and engaging. You know, I get asked, as does George, about, well, will you define the outer boundary? Well, the answer is no, because that's the point of having consultation engagement. You know, we would be predetermining all our decisions if we were to set all this in stone now. That would not be the right approach. There's genuine openness and flexibility in what we're considering, but the mayor has raised this as an issue. He said the city has to deal with this as an issue. But the our things like hours of operation, the extent of zones, the permit regime, help for business, particularly small business, those are all issues that are being considered. They're all in the mix. We want people to contribute to that debate. And we will allow more time for that debate to progress.
Most of the surveys, certainly the ones I've seen, say that people actually, largely across the city, don't want residence parking.
Depends what you ask people, isn't it? You know, if you say to somebody,
well, people don't want to pay to park outside their own home. Generally, that's the the long and short of it, isn't it?
Right. But if you have a debate and a discussion with people around the quality of their neighbourhood, the rising challenges, say, around air quality and congestion. If you say that we want to invest in public transport, we want to make it easy for people to use public transport, we want Bristol to be a thriving economy, we don't want to drive people away from the city, but equally, we can't really allow vast tracts of the city to be a free car park 5 or 6 days a week. Well, so we've got to look at ways of managing what is a very scarce resource in the city and putting residents first.
Well, that would be nice. But, you know, it looks like, for at least certainly the criticism that you're getting is that you're turning International Car Parks, which is one of the richest companies in the world. It's an incredible source of income. People, you know that someone's got money if they've got a car, and when they park by the side of the road, I mean, even if it's through a visitor, paying for a visitor's permit, or, I mean, how, for example, are you going to cope with people who are servicing washing machines and plumbers, people like that, who need to park outside a place for maybe an hour, something like that, do a bit of work, maybe an hour and a half, and leave? They don't want to come out and find a parking ticket. That is not helping local businesses, is it, Mark?
Well, that's one of the issues the business community has raised with George and raised with me, and we are working on ways to solve that particular issue, and looking at what other cities and towns have done and learn from that experience. But in terms of the revenue, this is not about making cash. You know, the payback period for the capital is up until about 2022. And after that, we are required by law to spend any surplus that may exist on the parking account and on public transport. We cannot use it for any other purpose. We are not allowed by law. So this is not an attempt to subsidise the council tax or indeed anything else. This is about tackling the challenges that face our city, like other towns and cities have already done.
Well, will you be subsidising First Bus, for example, who have got this £2 billion debt at the moment that they're desperate to serve? I mean, I'm sure they'd love to have some of your money.
I'd rather not be subsidising First Bus anything, but we are where we are at the moment, and we have a number of routes that are socially necessary, which are not deemed to be commercially viable, that if we did not support, those services would not exist. So in terms of inclusion alone, I would not want to withdraw that funding. But, you know, I want First and the other operators to see Bristol as a growth market and to help encourage new people to use public transport. That's why, for example, I'm spending so much time on the smart ticketing agenda, because I think that could be a real game changer in our city.
Mark, well, I suppose one of the most important things here is to make the people to know where they can contribute to this whole discussion. And we've had another story in the Post this week. Green councillors accused of bias, not you, the Green councillors, on the parking zones, being getting criticism from some of the people in St. Werburgh, saying that there was hardly any proper advertising for the meeting about the residents' parking zone in St. Werburgh's, and criticism of the new Green councillor. I think he's going to be on here next week, actually. So how are these things, these consultations being advertised? How do people find out how they can have their say? And you have some genuine democracy rather than some kind of token consultation.
Mm. Well, I don't know much about this particular meeting that you've referred to in Ashley. I don't think it was part of the formal consultation. I think it was called by the ward members there, and all credit to them for doing so. What we want to do is have structured engagement through the neighbourhood partnerships. Neighbourhood partnerships meet on a frequent basis. Those dates are publicised. They involve the ward councillors. We want the neighbourhood partnerships to be the main focus for that community engagement, but also individual residents and businesses to also engage with us as well. Tell us the issues that are affecting them and how they think those issues can
but what
be
do they
addressed.
Do? Do people give you a ring? Or just look on the Bristol City Council
website?
They
can go to the website, www.bristol.gov.uk. They can send an email to respark, R-E-S, park, all one word, at bristol.gov.uk. They can email the mayor, they can email me, as they have been doing in great numbers.
I bet. And what about dropping into the council house? Is there any literature about where these meetings are taking place in there?
We will, over the next couple of weeks, be ramping up the public engagement side of what we're doing and publicising more information, updating the frequently asked questions that we have on the website, and actually pulling more resource into neighbourhood partnerships so that they can carry out this activity, which is extremely important. No two areas of the city are the same, so we need to shape whatever schemes come about at the end of this to match local circumstances, and we're very committed to doing that, but we've got to have regimes that work and are effective and are understandable.
Okay, Mark, we'll see how you get on. Now over to Marina Morris, who's got I think it's a healthy lifestyle you're looking at, Marina, this week.
Yes, hello. Recent research for the Jobs Roundtree Foundation warns that one-third of Britons are too poor to join in this society. But the victims of this inequality are not only the 20 million Britons who are excluded from the mainstream of the country and live in poverty. The quality of life of the rich and powerful at the top of society, who is driving for some imagine to be only self-interest, is an illusion. They could suffer from the darker side of their self-interested life and money orientation. This depression, chronic anxiety, stress, emptiness, comfort eating, obesity, and many other issues. A hedonistic family climate and stressful way of living life can also affect and hurt their children. The logic of survival and true prosperity is rooted in the understanding of our vital needs, not only be financially wealthy, but to feel good. These are different skills that we need to learn if we want quality in life. We are social animals. This sociability in our genes and a vital part of our prosperity is social ties and empathy, not separation, division, or boundaries. We have inherited and adopted to a common social culture of a lack of ethics, cooperation, caring, and obligation towards others. People are in poverty because society was designed to create wealth or profit, not to care about the vulnerable, and it is easy to neglect the deprivation of others. The nature of this 21st century globalized world is competitive, unequal, money-orientated, and full of consumerist individualistic pressures. This is an unbalanced, hostile environment. This instability, constant crisis, serious disruption for the environment, and consequential personal and family costs. The tendencies are an increasing gap between the poor and rich, both with the nation and between nations. The rich become richer, the poor poorer. The top one-fifth of the people in the world own 4/5 of the wealth. This figure a warning call about society's losses. Human resources and technology are key to this global competitive race. Unemployment is an unacceptable waste. Everybody has potential, and job is necessary for person's psychological well-being and development. If this potential isn't used as and wasted, it means we haven't produced goods, services, never created new ideas, billions of losses for the economy.
Marina, thanks very much. Now, Mark, that was one of the things we heard there, was a third of people are really excluded in Britain from society, and that's due to poverty. This was an article a couple of weeks ago. It seems to me that they don't really feature in Labour's new plan. There's a third of people, actually Labour, even though they may be their voters, may have excluded those people too.
Well, we're committed to seeing the rollout of the living wage, which certainly will greatly help people who are in working poverty, and that's why Labour's mayoral campaign in Bristol focused on that, and that's why our local election campaign focused on that. I think there's a really big issue around how you target support. I'm particularly concerned about children who are in poverty, and I want to see this government for focusing much more on that, but I think at a local level it's about how you join up the different services and agencies, how you commission jointly, how you target jointly.
But Marina's also talking about a lack of ethics in modern politics and the darker side of the world, all this stuff to do with being selfish and money oriented. It seems that Labour is veering over to this way of thinking.
I don't think so at all. You know, I see a party that is firmly committed to fairness. I think that we will, you know, should Labour form the next government, have a very difficult inheritance, But there are things that we will be able to do, hopefully in the short term, one of which I'm really keen that our government should do, and let's get rid of this pernicious bedroom tax, which I repeat is a tax. I defy the BBC to keep telling me that it's not, but it is a tax.
Yeah, he's ex-British Forces Broadcasting, John Darvill, so maybe that's where he got that slightly right-wing point of view. Anyway, Martin, a lack of ethics in modern politics.
Yeah, well, Marina knows very well, because I lent her the book by Professors Wilson and Pickett called The Spirit Level. And that shows, overwhelmingly, they've taken statistics from all over the world, unequal societies have much worse social statistics than more equal societies. And the very interesting figure is that more equal societies, like in Scandinavia, even the wealthy are better off in terms of their health and their well-being living in a more equal society than in a less equal society. And we're not just talking about equality of opportunity here, we're talking about equality of outcome. And they've set up a foundation to pursue this, and it's something that all politicians should take on board. Decreasing inequality in our society is an absolute goal, and I would ask Mark, as a fellow Labour Party member, we are committed to a decreasing inequality, aren't we?
Indeed we are. Absolutely. And if I just say, when Labour joined Mayor Ferguson's cabinet, myself and Brenda Massey, the two cabinet members, presented George Ferguson with a copy of The Spirit Level, because we believe that, you know, the ethic towards moving to a much more equal society and community should really be embedded in all of our policy interventions as a city.
But aren't you being taken for a ride, Mark, doing this residence parking zone? That is the... It's almost like, you remember the whole business with Gary Hopkins selling off the corners of the parks a few years ago? It's a really difficult thing to be dealing with, and it's you that's got to deal with it, and you're a Labour Party person.
I don't think you can acquaint trying to get better management of a scarce resource, i.e. parking spaces, with the Lib Dem proposals to sell off the green lungs of the city. I just don't think you can equate the two. You know, transport is a difficult brief. It's always high profile. But we simply have to tackle rising levels of air pollution and congestion, but also invest in quality public transport.
OK, Mark Bradshaw, Labour councillor for Bedminster, Mayor Ferguson's cabinet member for transport. After the news, Bilderberger and former Justice Secretary Ken Clark's plans to decimate legal aid.
On your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour.
Live from the Sky News Centre.